It's getting hot in here. Let's take off all our clothes.
Nope.
I am getting too hot.
Nope.
Jeffrey, no, vocal tank top on at this point.
Nope.
You're with a winner, so baby, you can't lose.
Nope.
I got secrets, can't leave Cancun.
Oh, my God. So now it is 7:21 in the AM here on WOTP. Okay. So it's Tuesday. It is on Taking Pictures Day, the post birthday edition.
Yay.
Yay.
Did you see all the dumpsters?
I did see all the dumpsters, and I love them. It was really cool. So my name is Jeffrey Sidoris from fadedandblurred.com, and with me the post boating Bill Wattman.
Yeah, I'm not. Yes, that is true.
You did some boating.
Not sure if I'm a fan of the boating.
Did you wear deck shoes?
Did not wear deck shoes. Actually wore my sort of sandally kind of things, which actually are not ideal for boating.
Do you wear them with socks?
But I did not have to. I did not have to scoot along the side of the boat like in Jaws or anything like that. At least not at high speed. So
probably a good thing.
But whenever I get on a boat like that, because it's a fairly, you know, it's like a 33-foot boat or whatever. You scoot along the side and you get out front and you like go up by the anchor and you go hoopa. Tie it off, you know.
Is that what you do?
I do.
Okay.
And it's fun.
All right.
But yeah, thanks for saying so. So how was your birthday?
It was really cool.
Yeah?
Yeah, it was cool. Breakfast at the diner. Thank you, Jimmy. Yeah. My favorite little diner. I've been going there since 19... probably 80... 1982.
Wow.
I've been going there since 1982. Yeah.
That's a
the
long,
Red
I
Hill.
I don't think I've
shop.
Done anything since 1982, except for Breathe.
lots of really great comments and well wishes, and the dumpsters were great. Thank you very, very, very much. It made a good day even better.
Yeah.
Bought myself a birthday treat.
What'd you get?
Zoom. You know these little handy recorders they've got?
I've heard that they're handy, yes.
Zoom, they're going to send me an H5 to play with. And I thought, you know what? I know I'm going to like this thing, and I don't want to have to send it back. So I bought myself a Zoom H5. It's the newest of the Zoom recorders that have come out. It's four-channel, two XLR inputs on the bottom of the thing. And then it's got replaceable, like swappable capsules on the top. It comes with an XY capsule that's each of the mics are individually shock mounted.
Okay.
And then you can get like an Omni mic for it. You can get a shotgun mic, or if you need additional inputs, you can get a capsule that's got two additional XLR inputs.
Now, is it true that this is, it has four, it can record four tracks?
Yes.
Okay. And it has a USB, so it's a USB interface as well?
Yes. And that was the big thing. You and I have been talking about, the way Bill records the show is with a mixer, USB mixer. So you come, you explain it better. You come out USB.
I have a USB interface and I come out of the output and straight into one of the inputs to record you. And then I record me by going straight into the other input.
And then USB back into Logic,
it's all over
right?
the one cable. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. So this is what I wanted to do. And I was thinking about getting a mixer. And then I thought, well, wait a minute. If this thing will do what I want it to do, I can kill two birds, one stone. I can have a field recorder for doing conversations, interviews, that kind of thing on the fly. And I can also use it as this thing. But it's so new. This thing just came out like a week ago that nobody knew whether or not it would do what I wanted it to do. So I ended up calling Zoom directly and talked to one of their tech support guys who said, yeah, no problem. It'll do exactly that. So basically I'll do the same thing you do and I'll come line out back into channel two and then XLR mic into channel or track one and track two. So same thing. It should work just fine. I'll do probably a little video thing when I get it. It should be here, I don't know, Thursday or something.
It's exciting. Yeah. Now, how much was it? Now, this is the H5, you said?
H5, was yeah.
Didn't they have an H6?
They have an H6 that's a six
very expensive.
Input.
It's like yeah, 500 it's bucks.
Six channel. $399.
Okay, 400 bucks.
But it's a monster. It's really big.
Yeah.
This thing is pretty tiny for what it does. And it's I want to say it was $269.
Okay, that's a decent price.
Yeah, not bad. I mean, it's you know, the H4 that's been out since, 2011 is still $239, $229, something like that.
Yeah.
So for, you know, a little bit more, you get better pres, more flexibility, and hopefully it'll work out. So I'm kind of excited.
Well, that sounds like a fun little present.
Yes.
Good toy.
So happy birthday to me.
Yay.
Hooray.
Where do you want to start?
What have you got? You've got
okay. Well, you
went to this Winogrand thing. Let's talk.
Okay,
talk.
So last week we had this big. Was it last week? Yeah, we had the big long discussion about them.
Was that the post meltdown show?
Yeah. nice. About the Winogrand exhibit, which is currently at the Met, but I think it'll be at SF MoMA and National Gallery or Chicago or something as well. Which is sort of a career-long retrospective, but a big part of it is that they pulled negatives that he either never printed or never even saw the film because he never got it developed, and put them as part of the show. And we had a discussion of whether or not that was, you know, artistically, morally correct, that people should be making choices for the artist posthumously, and whether editing stuff down after you shoot it is kind of part of the gig. And if you're not doing that, then you're only doing half the job, you know?
Right.
So I said, let's reserve our thing until we go see it. So I went and saw it with the Connors brothers. They're like the Smothers brothers.
Did you get all three, or did you only get two out of three?
Yeah.
So Larry and Mo showed up. Yeah. Curly couldn't make it.
Yeah, Chris, a great game. So we went,
kidding.
By the way, we went and had, Shake Shack beforehand.
And I hear it's a good burger.
Yeah. And Chris was giving it big rave thumbs ups. So yeah.
it was on that I just read a list of like the best burgers in the country, and for New York it was best burger in New York.
Interesting. I don't know that I would say that, but sure. Hey, can I one little aside before I get to the Winogrand thing? Something that Chris was telling me about. Apparently he has a D7, I hope he doesn't mind me saying this. He has a D700. Which is that's the full frame 12 megapixel, sort of like the same sensor as the D3, but in a smaller body, right? Isn't that kind of what that is?
Right.
Okay. From what, 5-6 years ago now?
Yeah, probably 09, maybe 09, 08, 09, somewhere in there.
And apparently it broke.
Great camera.
Yeah, it broke.
Okay.
Suddenly there was damage, like the casing broke open, kind of broke.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Did it take, like, as a result of an impact, or did it just
He doesn't
somehow...
know, and huh. No one's saying. So, you know, it happened. We'll leave it at that.
Okay.
But
DOA can't be repaired.
Well, that's the thing. So he sent it in to Nikon. Nikon. Yeah. And,
okay.
Yeah. And they gave him a quote to repair it. I forget what it was, like $300 or whatever it is. And they'll replace the shutter for him.
Oh, wow.
In the process, right? So basically make the camera new as new, you know.
Right.
And if
it's for $3, that sounds like a good deal.
Well,
that sounds like a uncharacteristically good deal
right.
for Nikon.
Well, I guess this is my question. This was kind of interesting, is that for him, even though that $300, if you put it towards a $700 new body that was 24 megapixel, whatever, you know, like these mid-range Nikons are, which would technically give you much better image quality because it's such a new sensor.
Yeah, but you're not going to get the ergonomics. You're not going to get that big, beautiful viewfinder. You're not going to get the build quality.
Yeah. And so I think he's decided to do it. And it was kind of an interesting discussion of whether, you know, sort of the when do you stay with the thing that you know because you know it works for you, even if there are much better things in front of you? You know what I mean? Like he's technically spending money to stay where he is.
Yes, but what he's getting, you've got to look at it's not you can't just look at the sensor.
Yeah.
You know, you've got to look at I think the way the thing was built.
Agree.
Button placement. I mean, it's a very ergonomically friendly camera.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people really like that one.
Yeah, I know several people who use 700s still and love them.
So I don't know. I thought that was an interesting thing. Like, would you ever do that? Would you ever?
The next camera that I buy. Well, hold on a second.
You have the D300, right? And you loved that camera.
I had a D300 and I loved it.
Why did you sell it?
You know what? Looking back, I really don't know. I thought I was getting something better, but and in many ways, the X Pro is better for me. Is it a technically better camera? No. Does it focus as well? No.
Yeah.
Does it have the same ergonomics? No. But I got what I wanted out of it, and that is a digital camera that reminds me of a film camera that I can treat as much as possible as a film camera.
Yeah. And I think that that's for him. That's, he said, you know, I don't need more megapixels. I'm not selling my pictures. I'm not printing huge, you know? And then I said, I added to that the fact that you don't have to worry about your storage and your computer being up to snuff and whatever. And he says, you know, I've tried the 7,000 and the, you know, the 53, whatever, you know, all these different sort of mid-range models, and they're just not the same, you know? So anyway, it's just interesting to me. It's
on megapixels, I wanted to ask you something. I want to, I'm putting,
is that the new gear show that we're working on?
Yeah, that's right. No, megapixels? This is that's funny on megapixels. I am going to, as I kind of hinted at, or maybe I didn't, but if I didn't, here it is. I'm going to put all of my artwork, almost all, I'm saving two pieces for myself because I really like them, but all the other artwork, I'm going to eventually be, over the next probably month or so, I want to put it up for sale.
Okay.
And whatever I get for it, I get for it. That's not really the point. The point is to make room in my head for the new stuff. But I want to photograph it so that once the originals sell, hopefully, I can do prints if I want.
Okay.
But here's the question. If I want to be able to do, like, these are 18 by 24 and 16 by 20. Is my Fuji at 16 megapixel enough to do that justice? Or should I, say, enlist the help of Patrick, who's got a 5D3, to come out and shoot them so I've got a better or bigger source image?
I think it might be, well, you know what, you get a really nice... You get really clean files with the Fuji, right? They're really, really sharp.
Oh, they're great. Yeah, I mean, if I'm shooting at 100 ISO,
yeah,
you know, and light
I think
them.
Well, one thing you could do is shoot top and then bottom, and then stitch it in Photoshop. Like, just, you know, tilt a little bit on a tripod.
Oh, okay.
And basically, and you could get X more pixels. You know, twice as many pixels, or, you know, you could get up to a 30 megapixel image or a 26 megapixel image or something just by.
Just,
you
know, go vertically. Yeah. Am I going to get that much distortion going up and down?
No, I mean, if you're, well, the problem is, what do you have? You have like the equivalent of a 50 millimeter lens, right?
Yeah. It's a 35, I mean, so it's like a 52 mil.
You know, I mean, technically.
Oh, now wait a minute. I can put my Nikon 50, which will be about a 75.
Okay. Well, there you go. Yeah. Longer lens would be better. Yeah.
You know, or even, you know, I've got
put your work on an easel, and, you know, line it up so you're flat to the surface.
Okay.
You know, what you could, I mean, since you have the printer and everything at home, you could shoot what you're going to shoot, like we're talking about, even without the stitching, and then make a print the size you want to make it and see if it's good enough.
Just see if it looks good. You know? I don't even have to make the full print. I can just
cut out part of it and
crop out a portion of it.
Okay. But I would try that. I mean, yeah, technically, sure. Well, how big? 18 by 24?
18 by 24, yeah.
I mean, 60 megapixels should be fine for 18 by 24. I mean, it's not going to be 300 DPI on both dimensions, you know, but I'm sure it'll look fine still. You know, it's like, it gets to the question of what's enough, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, hey, what, you know, have Patrick come out for lunch, you know?
Yeah. That's what I was thinking to ask him.
Buy him lunch and use
his.
Say,
hey, can we just do this? Yeah. I'll set it up, you know, preset it up, and then we can shoot for half hour, an hour,
yeah,
whatever, and get them all done.
And stitch his camera, and then you're at 30 something megapixels, you know?
Okay.
But I don't think you have to overthink it. Cause I think it'll look good either way. Okay. Just getting the lighting right and everything is most important. And use a gray card at least, you know, so then you get the colors right.
Right.
Nice soft northern light, you know, coming through the window or something. Some, you know, diffuse window light. Yeah, not bad.
Okay, thank you.
No problem. Wow, that we're like in a rabbit. We're down a rabbit hole inside of a rabbit hole.
That's right. That's right.
All right. So going back out one. Anyway, I thought
back to Winogrand.
Yes, back to Winogrand. So we go over to the show. We go over to the Met. Walk up. Go over to the thing, and it is all four rooms of the main photography area of the Met, which is typically a couple shows, you know, or a couple things going on, but it's all four rooms. They broke it up in, I think, three sections. One was like the early stuff, then when he's wandering around America, and then the last room was the sort of later stuff, which was all selected after he died, I think.
So you can't see his pics and these after pics side by side. They're in a separate physical area. No,
there were a few things that he hadn't chosen from the early negatives that were also in there. And remember how we said last week that the ones that he didn't choose, they printed a little bigger?
Yes.
I liked that idea in theory. In practice, it was only like an inch or two, a couple inches bigger in each dimension. So on a wall away from each other, you almost didn't notice which were slightly bigger. Okay. You know what I mean? If you were going to do that, I feel like you almost had to take it further.
Could you size-wise. See an aesthetic difference between what he chose and what was chosen for him?
There were a handful of the ones that, well, we'll get to that.
Okay.
In the opening text, they say that he shot, 36,000 rolls of film? 3,600 rolls of film. Anyway, it worked out to essentially two rolls of film a day, like 70 pictures a day, something like that. I worked out the math.
For how many years?
Over 30-something years, 36 years, yeah. Which is a lot of pictures, but for people who go out and shoot a lot, you know, there was probably days where he didn't go out at all and days where he went and shot four rolls, you know what I mean?
Right.
But, you know, if you worked it out, it's not a ton of images to a lot of people who go out with a digital camera who shoot all the time, you know? It was a lot, but not mind-blowing amounts, you know? It was mind-blowing amounts in the sense that it was film that he then had to store somewhere.
Sure. But he wasn't, as far as I know anyway, he wasn't taking 20 pictures of the same subject.
No.
Like you would with digital. Like you would, you could just sit there and bang out a bunch of stuff.
Yeah. He wasn't doing that, but he was doing snap, move a couple feet, snap, move a couple feet as something, some people were walking by him or something was interesting. So there might be 8 or 10 pictures on a roll that were all essentially of the same, you know, the same moment. That just sort of different angles from the same kind of thing. And those were really interesting. And I feel like the pictures that I had seen a lot, and I don't know if this is a bias from having seen a couple dozen of his pictures a lot before, those were the ones that did stand out to me. And I don't know if that's because I've seen them before or because they actually are better. And that's why people chose them in the first place. But there was definitely, I enjoyed the early stuff. I enjoyed some of the middle stuff and I really didn't enjoy the ending stuff at all. And it kind of was this interesting thing that got me thinking about the fact that here's the guy who was shooting that much, right? Tons, Jeffrey, like just, you know, piling it on.
Right.
And it did not make him better. He did not improve from picture one through picture 210 or whatever was in the other room, right? Like he changed, certainly. But I didn't think that his later stuff was better than his earlier stuff from the point of view of, oh, see, he's mastering his craft in some way.
Okay.
In some way, his vision got lost at the end. And that's what some people say. And I would agree with it. You know, we had that A.D. Coleman review. Remember, we were talking about the kind of stuff. And the stuff in the last room that was supposedly chosen from his archives by all these whatever really wasn't that good. There was a couple that were good. And so the rest of it was just like, wow, I can't even believe they printed this.
Is there anything from Winogrand himself to maybe substantiate that he wasn't happy with the work later in his career, and that's why he chose not to develop
a lot. Yeah, a lot of the later stuff he didn't even develop at all. And then there were some that they printed that were, it would say, marked on the contact sheet by Winogrand, but never printed. So he chose it in the sense that he made it a select, but he didn't make it a select enough that he ever printed it. It's a really interesting idea, the way things used to work back then, right? You know, that you could have all these pictures and you had to make not just decisions of, oh yes, this is 4 stars, this is 5 stars, but am I going to make the effort to create a print from this?
Right.
You know, the locks were higher then, you know, right. like the sort of river locks, you know.
Is there anything either in his own hand or his own voice to substantiate what you're saying, that the work wasn't better? Did he think the work wasn't as good later in his career?
I didn't see him say anything like that, but there was a palpable feeling that he was lost later in his life. Like the stuff that he was shooting was not engaging at all. Hmm. You know, it's almost like he lost his mojo. He would shoot singular subjects in very sort of more barren landscapes. You know, he wasn't in the thick of things as much. They didn't have nearly as much energy.
More isolated.
Yes. And people were less attractive, as it were. You know what I mean? So you look at the pictures and they're not. There was an interesting thing in there, in a letter from his first wife. I'm getting the details right. If I'm not, somebody correct me. But it was a letter, I think it was from his first wife, late 60s. He had already done, I think, one Guggenheim fellowship or, you know, like one of these things.
Right.
And so he was fairly successful in the sense that, you know, he was this photographer who had won awards and fellowships, whatever it is. And it basically said, you know, I've been trying to talk to you about this for a year now and it never gets around to it. So
wait, who is saying this?
This
Winogrand or his wife?
His wife writing to him.
His wife is saying, I've been trying to talk to you.
Yeah.
Okay.
And, you know, and we never get around to it. So here it is. And, you know, something needs to change because you can't pay our bills and I'm sick of waiting around for you to hit it big. And, you know, just being able to pay our bills would be a step up from where you are now. And, you know, you can't even pay my therapy bills for my therapist and the government's after us and, you know, back taxes.
Right. Right.
And like your point of view is, you know, like, I'll just wait till they catch up with me. And all this.
How did he die? I don't know.
Cancer, I do believe. In like 84, something like that. Mm. But it's interesting reading this thing, and it's like, this is a guy who at the time was fairly well respected in the field.
Right.
You know? And you sort of, it comes down to this question of, I mean, and he was friends with Arbus and all these other Friedlander and all these people, you know. But it got me thinking about, like, how do we define success? You know, obviously he was not successful from a economic point of view.
Right.
As a photographer.
At this point, though, he had the respect of his peers and of the photographic community.
Yeah. Right. And, you know, and now look, he's got a four room retrospective at the Met.
Right.
Which, you know, how many of the people listening to this show right now would be like, oh my God, that would be my dream to be able to, you know, all these things that we talk about sometimes. And it's like, dude couldn't even pay his rent. Mm. And obviously his wife did not see him as a success. You know, I get, you know, but apparently.
Did she leave him for this? Is that what happened?
I think that's kind of what happened. I didn't.
Like, I just can't do the struggle.
I wasn't reading between the lines. Yeah, but that's the idea. But it's just, it's crazy. I mean, it was like this typed letter in one of the glass cases in the middle of the room, which sometimes I find more, those sort of parts of an exhibit are more telling than the work itself.
Right. That type of context.
Yeah. But the question is, did at the time in 1968 or 9 or whatever it was, did he think he was doing great? Was he thinking, yeah, look, I'm doing what I'm doing and I'm doing what makes me happy and I'm doing good work and screw the IRS and, you know, sorry, wife, I can't pay for the thing for, you know,
I can't focus on that. I have to focus on
I don't have time for these details. I'm making something, and I'm making something that I'm proud of. It was really interesting to me.
You're a big Walker Evans fan. Who of the work that you've seen, and we can't know everything that they shot, but of the work that we've seen from each of them, mm-hmm. who's got the better signal to noise ratio, Evans or Winogrand?
I would go with Walker Evans on that one, but mm-hmm. I like his aesthetic a little better. I like Winogrand's aesthetic in small doses. I think some of it's really, really great. It's tough. It also, you know, like we were talking about when we discussed The Americans, whatever, in episode 20 or whatever.
Right. Robert Frank. For those of you who haven't heard that one.
Go look up that discussion. But we were just saying, you know, he shot, 2,000 rolls of film or something like that.
Right.
And the final show is 56 pictures or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's like, wow, I could get 56 good pictures out of 2,000 rolls of film, you know?
Yeah.
And you kind of think, if these 200 pictures are the best that this guy made out of 36,000 rolls of film or whatever, you know, I think there are a lot of street photographers who could come up with some really great stuff. Now, are some of them really magical? Yeah, they're really, you know, like any sort of street photography, if you use it as a mirror for what you want to see in it, you can see all kinds of stuff in it.
Do the really great shots in Winogrand's portfolio, catalog, what have you, do the really great shots elevate the rest of the work, or do they set themselves apart from it?
To me, I noticed the difference between the really great stuff from the not really great stuff. Mm-hmm. I feel like this. I feel like the show could have been two rooms and nothing but gold, and would have been more impressive. You know. Hmm.
Make it tighter, make it just focused a little more. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. I mean, there were some pictures that I would stand and stare at, and then there were a few that I just walked by where I was like, no, it's not getting, like, in 5 seconds, it's got nothing for me, you know? Mm-hmm. So I'm going to, you know, and when you have that many pictures, when you have four rooms of pictures, there's a certain amount of, you have to choose what you spend your attention on, or else you're going to get burnt out by the time you get to the end.
Right.
You know, like I may go see it again before it's gone. I don't know.
Did you go see the Kappa exhibit at ICP?
I did, yes.
How would you compare
that
the
was
two?
The Kappa in color one, right?
Right, Kappa in color, right. How would you compare those two in terms of presentation, just what was presented?
The Kappa in color was smaller. Some of the prints were bigger. I thought a lot of the Kappa in color pictures weren't that great either. But it was interesting seeing something that was so different for a guy that you know as one thing, mm-hmm, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it is interesting, though, that the way ICP puts up a show and the way the Met puts up a show, the Met is putting up a show in a much more traditional way. You know, ICP feels like more like a modern gallery, the way it hangs stuff and the way the labels are done and everything, and the different sizes, where, like, this show for Winogrand was like, all these prints were pretty much the same size, all at the same height, all the, you know, in a very sort of traditional museum setting. I mean, it's well worth going to see, but the fact that the guy was, in my opinion, so good in the earlier years of his life, and then you look at the later pictures, when you'd think after an entire lifetime of doing it, he would only get better at deciding when to press the button, you know?
Wow, yeah.
And he wasn't. It kind of made me rethink this whole practice thing that we talk about sometimes. You know, right. Obviously, there's always practice, and just doing it, you're going to practice. But, like, the
you
idea...
You wonder what was weighing on him, if anything.
Yeah, because we tend to think that the more you do something, the better you're going to get. And it's like, well, the more you do something, the more it's going to change. But it's not necessarily going to change for the better.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's going to change. And it could go, and I guess just by definition, better is a judgment call in general. I don't know. It just, between that and that letter from his wife, it was really interesting. And then they had some of his applications for the Guggenheim stuff. And
like for fellowships and that kind of thing. Yeah.
And it was like, you know, there was a part where it was like education. It was like, oh, I went to Columbia University for one semester, no, you know, degrees, none.
Yeah.
I did this for a year and a half, degrees, none. What special things have you been in? I was chosen for this one thing down in Florida. That's it. Other questions left blank, and then just a typewritten part of his application. You know, it's just so interesting. Whenever I fill out an application like that, I feel weird if I'm not don't have good answers for every single one of them.
Right.
Where he was just like, none.
Yeah, you know, this is what I do. This is what I do well. The other stuff isn't relevant.
Yeah. And you know, and his whole thing was seeing, I want to see America, you know, America's changing, and I want to, you know, all the usual kind of stuff. I don't know. I still don't know where I come down on him. I mean, obviously some amazing photographs, well worth going to see the show, but made me think more about the man than it even did his photographs. Going to see the show.
Can we put a link to it in the notes?
Sure. Yep.
Yeah.
So anyway, interesting. And I think it's got to be going out somewhere else eventually, because they put it together with a few different people.
Mm-hmm.
It's good stuff.
Do you know, is it coming to LA or is it San Francisco?
Yeah, I was just going to look here. Blah 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 blah. Let's see. Prior to its presentation at the Winter Grand, it was on view at. Oh, it was already on view at SF MoMA and the National Gallery. Following its showing in New York, it'll be on view in Paris and Madrid.
Ah, okay. So I missed my window.
Yep. But interesting. I think this is the show that book that I have came from.
Oh,
the big hardcover one.
Right.
So we'll put that in the show notes too, just so if anybody wants to see the pictures, they can see the pictures. It's funny. Mm-hmm. I don't think I've even opened my Winogram book. I was going to keep it sealed.
I was going to say, isn't that the one you bought to just kind of keep it?
Yeah. But now I might open it just so I can reference things, you know? It's a different thing. It's also, there's something about, you know, the blacks you get out of black and white film when it's kind of, when people print stuff where the black just goes to ink, you know what I'm talking about?
Yes.
There's something about that sort of that sense that digital black and white doesn't ever quite get the same thing to me. And maybe that's just in my head. Do you understand what I'm trying to say? Do you agree or?
I don't quite know. Say it again.
There's something about the contrast and sort of the D-max of silver prints from film.
Okay. Versus
inkjet prints.
Inkjet prints. Okay.
And maybe that's not true. You know, maybe like you print on the right paper and it does get deep, but there's like this, the black stuff just feels like you could dive into it,
mm-hmm.
you know? And that's pretty cool.
Jean-Claude Pondivy, the guy that I really liked at Paris Photo this year, his prints, and I don't know what they were printed on, but it looked like they were printed in carbon or graphite or something. They were that rich.
Yeah.
And really deep shadows, but you could make out detail in the shadows, and they were absolutely gorgeous. So I think, if I'm understanding what you're saying, he nailed it in terms of printing paper and printing technique. It looked just gorgeous.
Yeah. And you know, it's like, we have so many tools now. There were times when you'd look at some photo and there'd be details in somebody's face that was in the shadow. And I could imagine if I had that picture as a digital file, I would be so tempted to try to go in there and pull up those details a little
Open
bit.
Open up the shadows. Yeah.
In a way that you really couldn't do very easily, you know, adding contrast is easy. Removing contrast in analog is hard, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's just how many, I wonder if the lack of, and this actually is true of our photographer of the week too, because I was looking at his pictures this morning where there's sort of, there's details in the shadows of those color pictures that, you know, there's actually not that much information on the film. That's why you only get like the hint of the details, you know?
Right.
And yet, you know, if you had them as digital, you'd try to pull that out or you'd see that as a flaw.
Right. Instead of just letting it do what it does.
Yeah.
You're letting the material be the material.
Right. Where in film, you almost had to let the material be the material.
Right.
And it kind of, I'll tell you, I've been trying to let the work that I do lately, I've been trying to work it less.
Yeah.
You know? Don't overstir the batter.
That was one of the things that I used to love about looking at pages of negatives where you could see, oh, that blew out, or oh, that went to black. I'm not going to get anything out of that. You know, don't even bother with that. I liked seeing those things.
Yeah. And you know, it's interesting too. They had a number of his contact sheets in those middle things with stuff. What's it called? It stuff, you know, blocked out, you know, a red pen, you know?
Yeah.
And really good contact sheets. The blacks on those is really nice too. You know, when they get the contrast right.
Yeah.
And I think if you shoot the same film and with the same camera and you have your soup the same way, where everything is just sort of, you get a consistent workflow, you can sort of build up, you can understand why guys who were, film shooters would be very particular about batches of film and this kind of stuff, and made it feel a little bit more alchemy based than anything, because there are so many different things involved. If you can remove as many of those question marks as possible, you get more consistent results.
Sure. Anyway. Well, and that was another part of the craft, right? Was knowing how chemistry affects it, knowing how temperature affects it, knowing how, if I agitate too much or too little, you know, all of these things are
variables. A degree in temperature makes a difference. Yeah. But I think what it is, the problem was, is that for so many people, it wasn't skill. It was magic. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It was part of the craft. The people who understood all of those details, I love that idea. But the people who got overwhelmed by, it just is what it is because it's magical and whatever it is, and I let Joe do it because Joe's the whatever. It's like, no, know the details or don't know the details, but don't talk about it like it's something more than it is. You know. Anyway, good show. Interesting. I don't know. Kind of up in the air.
All right.
Is that a bad review?
Yep. No, it's good.
You're like, yep.
You don't have to have an opinion on it. You can say, look, I don't know how I feel about this right now, but here's what I took away from it. And that, I think that's valuable.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah, I think so. Yeah, it's interesting. Interesting stuff. Yeah. What else you got?
After last week's show.
Okay.
Or maybe it was after the previous week's show. Anyway, the therapy session. Mitch Sevier sent me an interesting article called 10 Ways You're Making Your Life Harder Than It Has to Be.
I saw that movie. It's good.
What?
That's the one with
I don't know.
The guy who got killed and based on the Shakespeare thing at the high school.
No,
that's 10 Things I Hate About You. Sorry.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, so I'm looking through this list. I read through this list and I am, I don't want to say guilty, but there are 7 things on this list that I would answer, yes, I do that too. And I thought it would be an interesting discussion just to kind of go over them real quick. So I'm just going to go through them.
Yeah, what do you got?
Number one, you ascribe intent. Another driver cut you off. Your friend never texted you back. Your coworker went to lunch without you. Everyone can find a reason to be offended on a steady basis. So what caused you to be offended? You assigned bad intent to these otherwise innocuous actions. You took it as a personal affront, a slap in the face. Happy people do not do this. They don't take things personally. They don't ascribe intent to the unintentional actions of others. And I'm not going to tell you which ones I do.
Yeah, but isn't it kind of interesting, though, that while I agree with that, I also kind of think there are some things that are intentional, and reading into those can give you some sort of insight into other people or what they're thinking, or, you know, like,
sure. But by and large, you know, like,
why didn't my wife talk about dinner tonight? Well, she's pissed because of whatever it is. It's not just because she forgot about dinner. You know what I mean? Like,
right. But I think these are.
Yeah, fair enough.
More towards strangers. Yep, you know, the driver isn't going, I'm going to screw that guy. You know, whatever. Number two, you're the star of your own movie.
Yep.
Is it? I'm sorry. It is little wonder that you believe the world revolves around you. After all, you've been the very center of every experience you've ever had. You are the star of your own movie. You wrote the script. You know how you want it to unfold. You know how you want it to end. Unfortunately, you forgot to give your script to anyone else. As a result, people are unaware of the role they are supposed to play. Then, when they screw up their lines or fail to fall in love with you or don't give you a promotion, your movie is ruined. Lose your script. Let someone else star in it once in a while. Welcome new characters. Embrace plot twists.
Do you are you guilty of that one?
I told you I'm not going to tell you.
Okay. Oh, but you're not going to tell me which of these you're guilty of.
I'm not going to tell you all of them. No.
Okay. But yes, I'll keep my mouth shut.
I do that. I do that one.
I don't do that.
You know
that
what? I'll just tell you. I'll just tell you.
Do you do the first one?
No, I don't do number one.
Yep.
I do number two. Number three.
Wait, hold on a second. I do number one, but I don't do number two.
Oh, you know what? You are so the star of your own movie.
No, I really don't.
Yes, you are. You are the Clark Gable of your own plantation drama.
I wish that was true. Anyway, number three.
Number three, you fast forward to the apocalypse. I have a bad habit of fast forwarding everything to its worst possible outcome and being pleasantly surprised when the result is marginally better than the utter disaster or jail time. My mind unnecessarily wrestles with events that aren't even remotely likely. My sore throat is cancer. My lost driver's license fell into the hands of an Al-Qaeda operative who will wipe out my savings account. Negativity only breeds more negativity. It is a happiness riptide. It will carry you away from shore. And if you don't swim away from it, it will pull you under. Guilty.
All the time.
Yes.
That's where I live right there.
Number four, you have unrealistic and or uncommunicated expectations. Among their many shortcomings of your family and friends is the harsh reality that they cannot read your mind or anticipate your whims. Did your boyfriend forget the 6.5 month anniversary of your first movie date? Did your girlfriend refuse to call at an appointed hour? Did your friend fail to fawn over your tribal tattoo? Unmet expectations will be at the root of most of your unhappiness in life. Minimize your expectations, maximize your joy. Jeffrey, guilty again.
I'm guilty of that sometimes, but I've been with people who were way more guilty of that than others, than myself.
Number five, you're waiting for a sign. I have a friend who won't make a decision without receiving a sign. I suppose it's waiting on a trumpeted announcement from God. She is constantly paralyzed by a divinity that is either heavily obscured or frustratingly tardy. I'm not disavowing the fate or higher power plays in a role in our lives. I'm just saying that it is better to help shape fate than be governed by it. Once again, Jeffrey, guilty. Number six, you don't take risks. Enough said. Jeffrey, guilty again. Two words, live boldly. Every time you are offered a choice that involves a greater risk, take it. You will lose on many of them, but when you add them up at the end of your life, you'll be glad you did. I am so guilty of that one. Yeah. Number seven, you constantly compare your life to others. A few years ago, I was invited to a nice party at a big warehouse downtown. I was enjoying smooth jazz, box wine and crustless sandwiches. What more could a guy want? Later in the evening, I noticed a steady parade of well-heeled people slide up, past, and disappear into another room. I peeked in and saw a large party with beautiful revelers dancing and carrying on like Bacchus. Suddenly, my gig wasn't as fun as it had been, all because I didn't appear to measure up to the party next door, a party I didn't even know existed until just moments before. Guilty.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, guilty. Great quote by Teddy Roosevelt here, comparison is the thief of joy. Yeah.
The guy who was president of the United States.
Yeah. Number eight, you let other people steal from you. Now, this one I answered first no until I read the description and then went yes. If you had $1 million in cash under your mattress, you would check it regularly and take precautions to ensure it's safe. The one possession you have that is more important than money is time, but you don't do anything to protect it. In fact, you willingly give it to thieves, selfish people, egotistical people, negative people, people who won't shut up. Treat your time like Fort Knox, guard it closely, give it to only to those who deserve and respect it. Guilty. Number nine, you can't or won't let go. These are getting a little harder, aren't they? That's because sometimes you have to work at happiness. Some hurdles are too difficult to clear simply by adjusting your point of view or adopting a positive mindset. Do you need to forgive someone? Do you need to turn your back on a failed relationship? Do you need to come to terms with the death of a loved one? So I typically no, but that last sentence.
Sure.
All evidence to the contrary. Anyway, yeah. That's it. Number 10, you don't give back. One way to deal with loss is to immerse yourself in doing good. Volunteer, get involved in life. It doesn't have to be a big structured thing. Say a kind word, encourage someone, pay a visit to someone who is alone. Get away from your self-absorption. Not guilty of this one.
Yeah,
seven, possibly eight of the 10.
Okay. So verdict is guilty. Sentence is...
So we'll put this in the show notes.
Okay.
Guys, take a look at this.
Okay, wait. The rabbit hole discussion related to this.
Yep.
Are these things innate or can you actually change them?
I think it depends on
you and I could be mindful of not comparing ourselves to other people or what have you, right?
Yeah, I could leap more. I could not compare myself. Yeah.
You could consciously make sure that you do that for the next 3 weeks or whatever it is.
Right, right.
But for the people for whom that comes naturally, they don't have to think about doing it all the time. For people like you and I, say we're guilty of some of those, are the answers to them only Band-Aids because we just aren't that person?
I don't, speaking only for me, I don't think so, because several of these things I've only started to do in the last 10 years.
Okay. All right.
So prior to that, I've got, 30 plus years of not being this way, of not reacting.
30 plus years?
40 plus years. Yeah, whatever it is.
Yeah, yeah. Whatever that number. 20, 30, 40. Anyway, go
100.
Ahead.
100. Oh, and by the way, not one tennis ball Walker picture.
That's because people love you.
Yeah, well, that's all right. But dumpsters.
I asked for the dumpsters. I requested them.
By the way, I do need to, Alan Bailward sent me these little pencil cup dumpsters. Of course. They're like the little, like the ones that you put out on the curb.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're terrific. Anyway. Several of these I didn't used to do. And I have learned to do them, or they have been a result of some event or series of events.
You've fallen into something not by decision, but by reaction or defense.
Right.
Yeah.
And I have to choose to change it. True. I have to go, hey, all right, I'm going to redo this thinking, or I'm going to change the way I look at it.
Yeah.
But it has to be a choice.
Yeah, it's funny because you have to input energy to overcome.
Sure.
And so you'll only overcome as long as you're putting the energy in to do it. You know what I'm saying? And that's the part that exhausts me even thinking about it.
I think it will. It became a pattern that now doesn't require any energy. It's a lot of these things, they don't require energy. They've become my status quo.
Yeah.
They required energy at the beginning, but then they became a pattern. I need to reset the pattern. I need to reset the mechanism.
It's true.
And it's Kevin Costner out on the mound in For Love of the Game.
I was going to say that.
Yeah. You know that.
I like that movie.
Yeah. Clear the mechanism.
Yeah.
That's what I need to do. And that's what I've been working on. And I think just in the last few weeks, I've made some realizations. And I do want to point out that the emails, the texts, the tweets from you guys, the listeners, have not gone unnoticed, nor have they been in vain. They have helped and I thank you for that. So, but it is work. It is work until it no longer has to be work.
Yeah, it's the whole changing. what is the adage? You have to do something for how many days?
Like 21 days before it becomes a habit.
Do you think that's a true number? Or you think that's just a number some person pulled out?
It's probably arbitrary, but I think it will become habit.
Yeah, yeah.
I think I'm an example of that. It became a habit different than what it used to be. Several areas in my life.
Yeah.
I need to get back to where they were.
Yeah.
And I think I'm on that path.
You know, it's funny how the things you pick up, like things that become habits because somebody around you does them a lot or says them a lot.
Sure.
I was driving with my friend Craig the other day, and every time he sees a do not pass sign on the highway, he just thinks of Gandalf, like, you shall not pass. Yeah. It's like, and so now every time I see that sign, that's what I think.
Yeah.
But it's just funny how like those things just get stuck really easily. Yeah. Yeah, you know, this weekend I was, you know, I was up at my mother's house in Connecticut, and the friends we brought with us had a little I guess 10-month-old baby, mm-hmm. who's very cute, but like wakes up at 6 a.m., which means I woke up at 6 a.m. And instead of just lying there or whatever it is, and everyone else is kind of sleeping or, you know, sitting around with the baby, I went outside, and the neighbors have a couple kayaks, and I got in a kayak, and I kayaked up to the end of the cove that my mother lives on. It was funny because
end like at the mouth of the ocean, or end like back where
end it... back to the small part that little river that enters the cove, you know. And it's very interesting to me. There's one thing that I don't get enough of, and partially the city, partially working where I live, partially, you know, a number of things, which is sort of this meditative thing, you know. Mm-hmm. And it was a Sunday morning, so it was very much the same kind of feeling you get from going to church, which is why I can understand going to church from the point of view of something that you do every week for an hour that puts your mind in a certain wavelength, you know, sort of, you know, resets everything, resets the mechanism.
Have you ever gone to church?
When I was a kid, we used to go to church sometimes.
Okay.
When I was really little, we did, and then we didn't for a long time. And then when my father got sick, he did a little bit again. And we had his services in a church, but not really.
Mm-hmm,
I just I have certain beliefs that other people will disagree with, but yeah. But I can understand the whole just sort of grounding yourself, you know, the meditation. Have you ever been into meditation?
Yes.
Does it work for you?
Yes.
Do you still do it?
When I practice,
yeah.
I've started practicing again because it does help.
There's another example of something that is something you have to put energy in order to get energy up. In the same way
it can be a morning walk.
Sure, yeah.
But you have to choose to say,
you know what, I'm going to go out running right now.
That's another thing. Probably a month or so ago, I started running again. And I don't run 10 miles, but
yeah,
just that act of either listening to music or listening to nothing, but the crunch of your own sort of feet against the dirt, that's a meditative act.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's the other thing too. I didn't have my phone or anything on me. So it was 6 a.m. and there's no one on the cove. You know, it's mm-hmm. like just dead silence except for some birds. It's very satisfying in a weird way. Although I find kayaks very frustrating in the sense that you'd think that you'd go really fast in them because they're just little bullets in the water, but you don't really go that fast in them. So as much as you're like cooking away, you're just like, I want to go faster, and you just don't.
I haven't done the kayak. I like canoes.
Yeah, they have a canoe too, but I didn't.
I like canoeing.
Anyway, just interesting thought processes. What did Ashley Burton have to say to you?
This is interesting too. And this kind of goes back, we probably should have put this in different order. Kind of goes back to what you were saying about Winogrand and practice. Ashley Burton writes in and one of the parts of this email was, remember, it's not about amazing quote unquote shots or competition winners. And my themes are far from being fully developed, but I'll now approach shooting differently, understanding in a little more depth what it is that I'm trying to express. And that part, that what it is that I'm trying to express, is what got me.
Yeah.
And from the way it sounds like your takeaway from Winogrand was, he lost that later in his career. He lost what he was trying to express.
Yeah. His point of view became scared, it felt like.
Mm-hmm.
Or timid.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, that's a good topic.
I wonder what is more difficult, finding what you're trying to express or holding on to it for the duration of your career?
I think both are difficult. I think in today's culture with the whole, you know, we got to get this picture up to get a lot of likes or have it spread by social media or whatever it is. I think a lot of people really are stuck on the, I want to take this amazing shot without actually with not a whole lot of stuff behind it. You know, there was, I remember listening to an interview, somebody talking about SACDs versus CDs. SACDs are,
The super audio.
Super audio CDs. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was actually Ray Davies, I think it was, from the Kinks, talking about vinyl versus CD. That's what it was. But it was an article about SACD. And he was saying the problem, Ray Davies' opinion, the problem with CDs is that they don't sit on anything. Does that make sense? Like there's no foundation. Like there's no substrate. It's like a painting sitting in midair, not sitting on a canvas. For him.
Versus vinyl, what sits somehow on like wax cylinders?
Yeah, it's both the physicality of the medium, the fact mm-hmm. that it's actually touching it, I think, and just the sound of it feels like it's those sounds are painted on something orally. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. There's a physical reaction, not just an electronic interpretation. Maybe
yes, yeah, and I feel like in some ways. A lot of the pictures that I see, whether I like them or not, whether they're amazing or not, don't feel like they have a foundation that they're sitting on a point of view.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're just sort of free floating image. That's really great image. It's really nice, but it's not, it doesn't sound like it doesn't feel like there's an artist behind it. It just feels like it's a really great image.
Should there not be great single images?
No, I'm not saying there shouldn't be or they can't be, but I think that that has become the goal for a lot of people.
That's the expectation, is just a single great image rather than a sustained voice.
Yeah, Ashley's right in this, where it's like, yeah, you know, show me a great image.
Visual syllables, but not so much a word.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Okay. And and I think that now, look, I know people have been doing that since the beginning of time, but I guess I think part of the annoyance of doing it the old way with film, like we were just saying, you know, got to get developed. Oh, we got to get prints. So we got to make decisions. We got to make bigger prints. So like somehow that the effort it took to get through that process made each thing that you finished more important in the sense that you cared enough about it to get it that far.
Mm-hmm. And so there was effort on every level of the process.
Yeah. That you had to,
okay.
You see what I'm saying?
Sure.
You had to care enough to go through all that, not just care enough to say export and, you know, share on LinkedIn or whatever.
Right. I think that's definitely.
I'm not saying it's true of everybody, but
prevalent. Yeah. I think you can make just as much effort and just as many decisions not shooting film. The danger is in the immediacy of delivery. Or the expectation of immediacy and delivery.
Yeah. You know, I think Lightroom has some sort of, you know, share to whatever functions built in.
Right.
But I don't think I've ever used them. Like it's too much of a trigger sitting there, like a hair trigger gun. Right. It's like a loaded gun sitting in the.
Well, look, I have a friend who's a wedding photographer.
Yeah.
And I was talking to her, I don't know, a week or so ago, and she was talking about shooting a wedding and a person in the wedding party was kind of shadowing her, shooting their own photos more or less alongside her while she was shooting.
That's weird.
And she couldn't really say anything because she was part of the wedding party. And
she was just like basically copying everything this woman
did. more or less. And immediately just did this dump to Facebook of all of these images.
Right.
And this friend of mine was like, well, now what do I do?
Yeah.
You know, because a lot of the
pictures that I took have now been seen already in some sense.
Right. Maybe they haven't been seen as nuanced or as well as I did them, but to the general public.
Yeah, the thunder was stolen.
Right. That immediacy of expectation has now been met, and I'm going to come in and go, oh, but I've got this.
Yeah. Yeah. And then people are going to say, why the hell do I hire anybody?
Right. Right. So I see what you're saying, but I don't think that effort and that uniqueness and that process is unique to film. I think it's different with film, but I think that digital is every bit, or can be every bit as nuanced and every bit as deserving of the attention.
I didn't mean to say that. I guess I mean to say that it feels like the attention thing and the getting noticed has become a numbers game.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So sure. Both in likes and shares, but also in how much stuff you put up so that the chances are higher that somebody will notice you. And so it feels sometimes like people are just sort of vomiting onto the internet, work onto the internet. And I think that precludes a certain level of self-editing.
It can, sure.
Yeah.
Because that temptation to share is always there.
And if the guy you're competing against is posting four things a day, and that's why he has X amount of Instagram followers, because if you only post one thing a week, then not as many people are going to follow you. You know what I mean? Like, then you're it's an arms race, I guess, is what I'm saying.
And I struggle with it even
posting for Faded
things.
And Blurred.
Yeah, there are those sites out there that are posting 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 things every day.
Yeah.
And I just think that at that point you're screaming. It's noise.
Yeah. But how do you make people notice that that's noise, or you know what I mean? How do you make people?
I have to let go of that. I have to.
It feels like everyone's playing by different rules.
Sure. And at the end of the day, all I can do is put up the work that I find interesting, whether it's my own work or whether it's highlighting or celebrating the work of somebody else. I have to pay attention to my own vision or voice, because that's all I have, really. That's all I have control over.
Yeah.
That's all I have a say in. I can't decide what's going to happen. You know, it's funny, the things that some of these little rants that I've put up lately, living the long game or you know, whatever, I put them up for me. They've just been exercises in me writing how I'm feeling, and I don't think they're going to be taken very well at all. But those are the ones that people seem to comment on or share with their friends the most.
Well, look, the people who listen to this show don't listen to the show for when we talk about megapixels, you know. They tend to listen to the show for this, but that naturally lowers our audience, our pool of audience, right? The people who want to think about these things in this way, but the people who do, I think that they are thirsty for it in many ways.
Sure. I would agree. I would agree that there there is more engagement.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, I read comments on other shows and blogs, and yes, they might get more, maybe, but they're not anywhere near as thoughtful. They're not anywhere near as compelling, as introspective, or I would argue as honest.
Yeah.
As the level of discussion that we get here, whether it's email or in the OTP, the G+ community.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I'm really proud of that.
You know, there's I was listening to a podcast the other day that Marques Brownlee, you know, your friend,
yep,
was on, and they were talking about something about Netflix, and he said, and this kid, how old is that kid, 17?
18, 19, okay. Something like that.
He said that he doesn't have a Netflix membership.
Right.
And I think it was Tom Merritt or somebody was just like, really? You don't have a, you know, that's surprising to me because everyone I know has a Netflix membership. And he said that he doesn't watch TV or movies, that he watches everything that he watches on YouTube.
Hmm.
And so, and this is going to sound like a, where am I day? But like, is the attention span getting even shorter? Like, it's so short now that a 21 minute sitcom is too long. That we're down to.
Or maybe he finds these things. I mean, look, you can find a lot of TV shows and movies on YouTube.
Yeah. Maybe he's doing that. But he said, you know, I don't watch a lot of TV shows and movies. I watch videos, and then I'll link to other videos that are like that. That's just a whole other way of thinking about it, you know?
Yeah. It's fascinating. I spent a bunch of time over the weekend watching TED Talks.
Always a good idea.
TED Talks, if you have not experienced these things, what they are doing and how they are delivering knowledge and opinion and information and creativity and insight and it is fantastic. And you know, you can, one of the things that I really love about, and there's a Zay Frank one that's fairly new. It's the human test. How do you know if you're human?
Right. I haven't watched it, but I've gotten
links to it. It's terrific. Love Zay Frank. Thank you. Cause I didn't know about him before you, but you know, you can see like Stefan Sagmeister's favorite videos, or right. You can see, you know, so-and-so's five favorite TED Talks. So there's this sort of branching and
how did that guy become famous in that world?
Stefan Sagmeister?
Yeah. What was it? What are the projects that he did that made everyone think that he was the next second coming?
There was a poster that he did that he carved the typography into his own skin with an X-Acto knife and then photographed it.
Okay.
That was one gigantic, big, famous kind of project that he got a lot of notice for. He makes typography out of other things. He's just innovative in the way he thinks and approaches graphic design.
Right. But if you showed his work to my mom, would she recognize any of them, or is it more of a?
I don't know that she would recognize them as right. Stefan Sagmeister.
Where people would recognize what's his name, who, you know, Saul Bass, or you know what I mean, like or, you know.
Uh huh. Sure. Yeah. I don't know. I think, you know, a lot of people have called Sagmeister like the designer's designer.
Yeah.
You know, those people, like if you asked Craig about him, he would right. probably.
Oh sure, yeah. Yeah.
Think, oh yeah, he's great, you know, whatever.
And anyway, just interesting.
Yeah. So yeah, I spent a lot of time on the TED Talks, and I think it is a different way of looking at things, and I think it's a natural evolution that you know, Marquez, 19 years old, has a different way of looking at things.
Yep.
And I think he's much more forward thinking than most people out there. That's why he's got, you know, 80 bajillion followers. And that's why, you know,
He's CEOs not watching TV because he's too busy making 4K videos about products that aren't released yet.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, did you see the video that he did on the, is it or isn't it Sapphire?
Yeah.
But then
some
iPhone.
People are arguing that he did some stuff wrong on that. I read an article.
Maybe, but still, I mean, you got 10 million views on this thing or whatever. You know,
he's a force to be reckoned with.
Absolutely.
And seems like a really sweet kid.
Seems like a really cool guy. Yeah.
Hey, you know what? I think I may have to just, I won't buy this thing, but it's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Hasselblad has announced a 50 megapixel back for existing 500 series systems.
Yeah, so if you've got that sexy 500cm, you can pop on a 50 megapixel back. Now, my question, because I remember talking to a friend of the show, Carl
sensor.
Taylor, about this, and he was saying that the optics are going to be your limitation, because the new lenses for the H4, H5, even H3 are designed for the new digital sensors, whereas the existing optics aren't.
He may be right. Look, he shoots at those things every day and I don't, but my initial reaction to that would be that sounds like a bunch of marketing BS to me.
Yeah, but why would that be any different?
There were some really amazing lenses made 20 years ago that before they came out with the H series.
Sure there were. But they're also saying now that even with full frame sensors and crop sensors, that the higher the megapixels, the more critical it is that you buy really good glass.
But you know, a 2.25 square negative it requires really good glass too. You know what I mean? Like, look how many famous things were shot with Hasselblad 500s. That you know, I think that it would still look good. My issue with it is that if this sensor was square and the size of a piece of film, I would save up and put one on a credit card right now. But it's not. It's the same sensor that's in the Pentax and everything else, which means that it's much smaller than that, which means you have a crop factor. And then apparently there's a square mode where it'll crop it even more. So maybe you get like a 40 megapixel square image. But it's going to be like in the center of the thing, which means that you get the best part of the lens, much like crop sensor, digital SLRs.
So what are we looking at? We're looking at 43.8 by 32.9 millimeter.
Yes. which is, you know, 4.3 centimeters by 3.9 centimeters. So it's, you know, size of two postage stamps maybe next to each other. It's not the size of a...
So why not go to a 2 1/4 size sensor? Are we still cost prohibitive?
Yeah, we don't make them that big. No one's made them that big. They're just too expensive. I mean, and, you know, you get to the point, though, where you kind of think, okay, yes, if you want the field of view to be the same on this sensor versus the film that you used to use, yes, we need a sensor that big. But if a smaller sensor, a slightly smaller sensor can give us really great image quality, then really what we're talking about is just that you're used to an 80 millimeter lens looking like this field of view, you know, sort of those kinds of games that we play. I don't know. I think this thing is cool. If it was 8,000 instead of 14,000, I'd think it was even cooler, you know?
So we're looking at 1.29 inches in the vertical.
Yep.
By 1.72 inches in the horizontal.
Yes. Yeah. Small, much smaller though than a 2 1/4, obviously. Square thing.
So bigger, larger than full frame, but not,
yeah,
still not medium form.
And then if this thing, let's say the it's lined up so that, because that sensor is not square, so it's got to be in one orientation or the other. And let's say they have it set up as portrait orientation. How do you shoot landscape shots? You just hold the camera on its side? Well, it's got a waist level viewfinder for a lot of people, you know? Mm-hmm. So now you got to buy the eye level viewfinder, and those things are kind of expensive and annoying in my
opinion. I wonder why not make it 43 millimeters on both ends. Why not make a square
one
at 43.8?
Because they're getting them from Sony, you know? Wait, do you make them square in the smaller dimension?
No, make them square on the large end, 1.72 by 1.72.
I think that would be great, but I think Sony's making a sensor and they're selling it to people. I don't think Sony's taking special, you know, special requests. A couple other things. Yeah. So the orientation thing was a weird thing to me. Like in, on the old RZ67s and stuff, there was a switch and you rotated the back and you locked it again. So you could switch the orientation of the back. So it changed whether it was portrait or vertical.
So the back moves, the actual sensor, or in that case, film, would move, not the camera.
Yeah, that rotated 90 degrees, which actually was awesome with the waist level viewfinder. Now, the RZ was annoying because it was weighed 76 pounds and, you know, chunk. It was a cool thing. So there's that. And then it's still using FireWire 800, which is, you know, definitely on its way out as far as, you know, just interesting choices. Sometimes I see companies like Hasselblad and even Phase, and I know they're going for a different market, and I know it's a smaller market, and it always feels like the technology that they're using has been in, it's like they decided this camera 2.5 years ago.
Well, I wonder why the sensor dimensions on the, I'm looking at the H5D.
Right.
Which is also 50 megapixel.
Right.
Sensor dimensions on that, 36.7 by 49.1 millimeter. Why not just use the same dimensions there? Why not? Why make a completely different product?
Well, because this one's CMOS. The one you're talking about is the CCD sensor.
Oh, right? That's the CCD. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Are you looking at the H5D50C? Because that
H5D.
One, okay. The H5D50C is the CMOS one.
Okay. Hold on. What do we got here?
Which is a different size sensor. Let's see. This is riveting radio. 32.9
yes,
by 43.8. Is that what the other one is?
I think
32
so.
By 43. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
So they're using that same sensor.
Same sensor. Okay.
And it's all the same Sony sensor. Same one Phase is using, the same one Pentax is using. I think
it's just interesting. I would love to see somebody come out with a square instead of having to do some sort of weird software interpolation or
If this thing had a full-size square sensor, that would be my new camera.
It would probably be three times the price, though.
Yeah, but
it's already $15,000.
But I would love that camera for the kind of stuff that I shoot. I would love that feel. Like, yeah. I like the waist level viewfinder. I like using the Hasselblad. I think it's interesting because it's not in front of your face. It's down below your face.
Yeah.
And there's just something really different about that. It's like you're interacting with your subject and the camera is just sort of this impartial thing that's separate. You know, it's not in between.
Well, I think that's part of what made Avedon so great.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, it was his technical ability, his aesthetic, but it was also his connection with his subjects.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, he's out there moving and dancing and, you know, being active with his subjects, and he's making eye contact with them.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the things I really miss, even shooting with my 5D. It's like, but I don't have another option. Because even if you bought the Pentax, or even if you bought one of the new Hasselblads or whatever, most of them are all just this, you know, eye level viewfinder. Yeah, they have waist level things for some of the Hasselblads, but like, it's not the same as this. You know, I liked this process and take a shot and you got to wind to recock the shutter. Like, sure. I'm okay with that. I don't need to go bang, 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 bang. You know? So this is really interesting to me. It's just like, it's too little, too late, too much, too little, too much and too late.
Yeah.
In some ways. Yeah. It's super cool though, that they actually came out. You know what? It feels a lot like that weird Nikon.
Which is the DF, the newest.
Right? It's like, we're going to stick a digital sensor in the old camera. That's what you all wanted, right? It's like, yeah, that's what we all wanted, but you screwed up a lot of the details.
It is gorgeous, though. That's totally one of my favorite camera designs ever, is the 500C.
You ever shot with one?
Nope.
Oh, you got to find somebody who has one. Because you would, you'd fall in love.
I saw one a few months ago at one of the camera fairs in Pasadena. It was a black on black, you know, and it was just absolutely pristine. Looked like it just came out of the box. Guy wanted $1,000 for it with the 80 millimeter lens.
Yeah. They're not that much nowadays. Like mine is an old one from, mine's really old. It's a 500 cm.
Yeah.
And it's super old. And one of the things that a lot of people do, I think this is super camera nerd for a second. The film backs and the bodies had serial numbers, and there were matched serial numbers from back.
Oh, okay. From back to body.
No. You know what it was? It was from the part of the film holder that you pulled out to put the film in, and then the casing of the film holder, I think. Anyway, there was some kind of thing where, like, if you have matched ones, that's better than having unmatched ones, because potential light leaks, which I've never had a problem with, or, you know, some kind of thing like that. Because a lot of these, I mean, they were machine made, but these are not perfect. You know, they're still sort of handmade. It looks cool though. Look at that.
I have for a long time, have wanted one of these 500 CMs.
Yeah. That would not be a awful thing for you to buy for yourself if you were actually going to shoot film, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway, that's pretty cool, and I wish that they had made it the way it's so close to what I would actually want, but not quite there. You know, what are you going to do? All right, what else do we have?
It could be worse. You could live in a tunnel.
Did you see these pictures? They're cool.
I did.
So this, I found this on Photographer, but it's called The Hidden World of World War One, and this guy apparently underneath the trench warfare in World War One, there were private land and private landowners who had, they basically built cities in underground mines and things, unused mines, or they dug out sections for support stuff during World War One and everything. And now they're in the hand of these private landowners. And so they haven't been touched for decades and decades and decades. And so this guy got permission and went down into what he says. He says, I found a world frozen in time, notes to loved ones. I found evidence of people living day to day. And it's all these crazy, you know, cut out staircases and people writing on the wall and making art on the walls and drawing pictures of people kissing, you know, essentially, you know, it feels the bottom picture of the table with the bread on it. Or the canteens, rather.
With the bottles and everything.
Yeah. And you look at it and you think, like, look at that, the bench on the wall just made out of, you know, a few things of wood.
Post and lintel construction bench. Yeah.
And it's like, that could be 1914. It could be 1814. Yeah. Like, the things, World War One was this strange straddling of the 19th century and the 20th century. Like, we were killing each other in 20th century ways, but we were still kind of living in 19th century
tactics.
You know what I'm saying? It was it's terrifying. World War One scares me so much more than World War Two or Vietnam. Like, if I have bad dreams about being in a war, World War One is like the nightmare scenario.
Jeff found chapels, a synagogue, several large theaters, etc. in the 6 months that he spent exploring the region. He stumbled upon the spot through networking. When he traveled inside the caverns, he was completely awestruck. The often treacherous work was performed in complete darkness and sometimes required him to crawl on hands and knees through tight spaces over jagged rocks and lean down over ledges, balancing camera in one hand. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. This isn't very interesting. I got
two words for that, Jeffrey.
Yeah.
Screw that.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. You, like heroin, you know what's never a good idea?
Yeah, yeah.
Crawling around in the dark.
World War One tunnels.
Yeah, yeah.
Man, I wish... Sometimes I look at this stuff and I'm like, I wish I had the balls to do that.
Yeah.
Like, I know that's a great experience, whatever it is, and the images are totally amazing, but at the same time, you'd imagine that the actual crawling around in the dirt would be terrifying.
Do you have the stones to go get those images?
Nope.
Nope.
Nope. Nope. Am I supposed to say yes? Nope.
Yeah. Nope. Pass.
God, you and I are such wusses, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, well. Hey, what'd you think about, did you see the pictures that went around a lot last week of... The baby that died and the parents had people retouch the images to get the tubes out of her mouth. Yeah. What'd you think of that?
I thought it was touching that so many people in the community, in the Photoshop community, in the post-production community, kind of offered their services so that this father would have something to remember his child by. I thought that was very touching.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah.
Tough gig.
Very. Yes.
God, there's nothing... All that kind of stuff is just terrible.
A parent, never having been a parent, but a parent should not have to bury their child.
No. Yeah, at any age, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Of course, it's not that much fun burying a parent either. So
No, it's not. But I thought it was really cool that so many people... participated and there was just this outpouring of support for him, and I thought that was really fantastic.
Yeah, got a lot of press. Hey, one last thing on the French tunnels.
Yes,
apparently he also found unexploded hand grenades and live artillery shells.
Yeah, good plan. It's a good idea to be in a dark tunnel with live ordnance.
Oh God, that's so terrifying. It's so terrifying.
Hey, what's this? Click, 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 yeah. Click, 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 oh, man. And,
what is that from Hot Fuzz? It's like, what is it? Sea mine.
Yeah.
Sea mine?
Yeah.
Sea mine.
Not a good thing. Not a good thing.
All right. So how did the group do last week?
Really, you know, a lot of jumping.
I saw some of these. These are good.
Really fun stuff. Dogs jumping, people jumping, a lot of kids, summertime, great stuff. Really fun, really, really fun stuff. People still putting in typography and circles. So these things have sort of lives beyond us. And I'm so thankful and love looking at them and love, you know, going through.
I like
through and
Lance's
commenting.
Picture of the bunny jumping.
Very funny. Yep. Yeah. Yeah. It's Fielding posted that. Did you see that one of the checkers? Like,
yes,
jumping. That was cute.
Yeah. Mitch Sevier pulled out a strobe for you.
Right?
Just saying.
I know it. Holger. Is it Holger? Would it be a hard G or Holger? Holger.
Holger. I would say Holger. I would say J.
Sorry, Holger. Holger. For butchering your name.
Yeah, try his last name.
No. Farouge? Holger Farouge? I'm sorry. Please correct
God,
us.
That's hard.
Call in.
Leave a message.
Yeah. Yeah, really fun stuff. Nicholas Govis took a trip to the Las Vegas Neon Museum, the Boneyard in Vegas. I thought that was kind of fun. Had nothing to do with jumping, but fun stuff.
Neon, man.
Yeah. Apparently, you're only allowed one camera, one lens no camera bag, no backpack. You can't bring anything into this place.
Because why?
I don't know, because it's theirs and, you know, you don't.
But they do
it.
Let you in with a camera?
With a camera, yeah. One camera, one lens.
I remember, you know, speaking of neon, I remember one time, 1987, maybe?
Mm-hmm. Oh, Michael Hendrickson. Really fun jumping photo, too, by the way. Anyway, go ahead. That's a minute.
And it was my father was getting a new neon sign made for one of his stores.
Right.
And it was on a set, or for some reason I was at work with him or something, and we ended up going by this guy's shop after work on the way home to check on the sign. And he had on the walls, you know, all this old neon, including a lot that had gases. Like apparently there was like a ruby red gas that was incredibly illegal now because it was very poisonous, but that they used to use like back in the 30s or 40s. And the only way to get that color now is to buy old ones and siphon the gas into a new tube.
Oh, wow.
Because it's illegal to manufacture. And, crazy. And so there were certain gases and certain colors and things that would cost money because they were essentially, you know, transfers from older signs because they were
now
illegal.
You had to source it from existing. Yeah. Wow, neat.
Yeah. And I remember, it's like, it's funny. I have this weird, very vivid memory of being in this room. Maybe I was a little shorter because I remember sort of looking up at the counters where he was working, like his workbenches, and all this crazy old neon on the walls, which at the time was probably only 40 or 50 years old.
Right.
But it felt like it was ancient, you know.
How fun.
Yeah. So neon's super cool.
There's a museum of neon art in Los Angeles, and they do like these double-decker bus tours around Los Angeles.
Pointing at old signs.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, see, I would totally do that.
Yeah.
There was, you know, there's that, who's that artist who worked with fluorescent tubes was his big thing. Like he would put like two or three next to each other and one underneath. Like he would make really graphic stuff. There's a ton of his stuff up at Dia Beacon, like a whole room full of his stuff.
I don't know.
It's like some modern artist. Basically, he was just making structures out of
Fluorescent tubes.
Out of fluorescent tubes, yeah.
Huh.
Anyway, so what's the assignment for this week?
Assignment for this week is we've seen where you live, we've seen where you work, we've seen family, friends. Today this assignment all about objects. Yeah. So want to see my favorite things.
Want to
see your favorite things in your life. Your desert island objects, if you will.
Okay. And nothing not safe for work.
Right. Yeah. Right. So, yeah. I found my special purpose.
Yeah. Zip. Yeah,
from the jerk.
Yeah.
So hashtag my favorite things. You know, just show us a few. Huh? Huh? Yeah. Okay, you gotta stop. We're gonna get sued. So my favorite things. Have fun with it.
Okay.
What are some of the things that you grab in a fire or your desert island, and these are the things that you would bring? What are these things?
Good one.
Yeah. What do you got for photographer of the week? I'm going to give you this one.
Oh, you're going to make me say this?
Again, this came from either Holger or Holger.
Let's see. Georgi Pinkasov.
I think we're solid there.
But Pinkasov.
Georgi. It's a GUEORGUI.
It sounds like it's almost like written backwards.
Yeah. So hey, it's Georgi Pinkasov.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe it's some weird, like, yeah, phonetic like spell, Russian Dawson phonetic spelling. Yeah.
Yeah.
Russian by birth, right?
I believe so. Yeah.
Magnum photographer moved to, born in Moscow in 1952, has since moved to Paris, lives in Paris, is now a French citizen. Another Magnum photographer, isn't he?
Yeah.
You, man, people love, we do a lot of these Magnum photographers.
But really good stuff, though. His composition and use of light and shadow,
yeah,
particularly light passing through things, whether it's window or scrim or trees.
It's interesting because he tends to use windows a lot and passageways as framing devices.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I put up, there's a link in there, the WordPress link in the show notes, has a bunch of good stuff of his.
A lot of pattern. He's a fan of pattern.
color film guy. Very all right with letting shadows go to black again.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder how much of that is in his choice of film or is in choice of printing.
I really like this guy's work. Good. Yeah. Suggest.
It feels, I'm going to get in trouble for saying this. A lot of it does feel very sort of Soviet.
How so? How do you mean?
Well, I mean, it's like the people on the buses and, you know, there's lots of military guards, right? Like standing there. Like
that's an accurate reflection. So
it has a slightly sort of oppressive feel to some of the photos where people are in public.
I love this ballet shot, number 24 on the WordPress.
Yep, yep. Zip, zip, zip. 24. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's a great shot. Kind of we're in the wings, you know, waiting to go on.
It's funny. It feels not unlike some of the pictures by a friend of the show, Cisco Graciano.
Yep.
It's I'll tell you, man.
So oppressive. That's how you would describe this.
Well,
work.
Not all of it, but just some of the earlier stuff, like some of the initial pictures that were very, very Russian, very sort of like solemn and whatever. But you can tell when he sort of moves more to France. There's an interesting one. Do you see number 40 and number 41 sort of mimicking each other? There's a guy working outside, like shoveling
whatever
it is, drinking water out of a cup. And then the next, like by sticking his head up and turning the cup into his mouth.
Right. And the girl in the background.
Yeah, he's eating like shrimp.
Yeah. Further down that page, number 52. Kind of echoes what you're talking about with this sort of papers, please.
Yes, and sort of that hard flash in the. It's also something about, you know, the film of that era, and I don't know, you know, who knows what film he was using. I'm sure Russians must have made their own film because they weren't importing Kodak, you know, not in the 70s and stuff. The colors are not correct, but they're really interesting.
Yeah. Little more muted. Sometimes they're shifted to the blue. Sometimes they're shifted to the yellow.
Yeah. And like this picture, I mean, that red is pow, yeah. You know.
Look at numbers 69 and 70. Look at those. You've got 69 kind of shifted toward the blue-gray, and then 70 right below it shifted toward the warm.
Yeah. Yeah. So but I don't know if those are decisions he made.
I like his work. Wow. Great suggestion.
You know, you ever notice that people used to smoke a lot more than they do now?
I think
you think they still do, or
I think they still do. It's just not, you know, they don't show it.
Yeah, like just that idea that like there's three or four people sitting around a table all smoking cigarettes.
Yeah. Number 76, beautiful.
Let me see. 76, 76.
That's nice. Great shadow play there.
Yeah, I like 76
and 77.
And
again,
77 with the ballet. Bands.
Yeah, yeah. Great stuff. Really, really nice work. But yeah, I mean, representative of the color and maybe the tone, not tone physically, but emotionally, psychologically of what he was photographing.
Yeah. And a very strange, interesting, back and forth between, oppressive sort of Eastern European at the time, probably communist regimes. And then obviously people flying on very fancy airplanes or in, sort of the more French side of,
91 and 92, kind of polar opposites.
Yeah,
got
I wonder
the bus
if,
and the traffic, and then the guy you know, on the plane. Plane eating.
Yeah, right. But then you go down too, and there's all these like naked women being decadent. You know, it's just very interesting. Yeah, he's kind of all over the place, but they're lovely pictures.
Yeah, they're really good pictures.
You know, it's interesting. You can things you can do with color if you're willing to let color do some work for you. Is use the color tone to give the picture a character that it wouldn't have if it was absolutely correct color.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, number 99. these houses with all these telephone wires and stuff. Like, there's just something about... It's interesting. I guess, I mean, you could get that shot on digital, but it has a very... Some of these pictures just feel very much like scanned film to me.
So do you think this photograph in particular, number 99, is film doing what film did? And if you shot this digitally, it would take a little more work to get it here? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I guess, you know, it's kind of like what we were talking about at the beginning, where it's like, you know, just let the material make some of the decisions for you, which is why you chose that material in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean...
Some interesting stuff like, on his
look
Instagram.
Look at number 72. Too. This like woman on this bus.
72. Hold on. Get there right meow.
Like the blues versus the yellows, like the blue in the sky outside versus like sort of the warmth of the yellow getting hit in the bus.
Yeah, yeah.
But she, like, if you shot that on digital, I would try to pull the shadow slider to see if I could get some information in her coat.
Yeah, but she becomes almost just a silhouette.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it works because there's no information in her coat. If there was information in her coat, it would be a boring picture.
Yeah.
It's just, it's weird. And it's like, and I'm guilty of this myself, you know. In some ways, the modern stuff gives us, it's just too many options, you know.
Man, this is good stuff. Yeah, so check out this link. Check out his Instagram feed.
Yeah.
He's got some really interesting things up there.
And I'll put the links in the show notes.
Good stuff.
So what did we decide? Did we decide it's Georgi Pikasov?
Let's go with that.
And yeah, it does seem like it's trying to say Georgi, but spelled in a phonetic way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right. Good one. Good recommendation.
Yeah.
Any further thoughts?
Nothing of any relevance.
So if somebody's going to leave us, say, a correction for a pronunciation, they could do that at 347-687-9411. You could use Skype or something to call in if you're from out of the country.
Yep.
That would be 01, I guess.
Google Voice.
Would be.
Yeah. Can you do Google Voice? Sure. Did they update Google Voice to allow, or have you always been able to call landlines?
Yeah, I think so. And they've been pushing Google Voice over to merge with Hangouts, I think.
Oh, really?
But people who want to get in touch with us, let's say it's podcast@ontakingpictures.com is the email
podcast,
address.
That's right.
And you can find Jeffrey and I on Twitter, Jeffrey Sidoris, ERYDD1R, and Bill Wadman. No L in there, just WADMAN.
Do people get that wrong? Do they try Bill Waldman?
Some people do. I find a lot of times people linking back to me, like if I go look at, you know, refers, and I'll go look and it'll say Bill Waldman. And I'm like, no, I'm not Bill Waldman, which just, you know, messes with my Google mojo. If people spell things wrong. So it's like, get it right.
Why don't you buy BillWaldman.com and just do a 301?
Because I think
redirect.
That's actually a common name.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. Let's see. Bill Waldman. Why can't
all right, while Bill's looking that up, my favorite things is the project for the week.
It's owned by Lake Gardens Property Association.
Lake Gardens? Huh.
Yeah.
All right.
Anyway,
if you've got anything interesting you want us to check out, or just say, hey, go look at this, leave it in the Google Plus group or you know, tweet one of us or something.
Yeah, send us an email.
Send us an email,
and,
whatever you want.
If you want to give us money so Jeffrey and I can buy
give us
Hasselblad
money. Yeah. Send the check to. Yeah. 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 Good stuff.
See you next week.
Yep. You got anything else?
No.
You good?
I think we're good.
All right. Good. Thank you for listening, everyone. And thank you for all the birthday wishes. I really appreciate it. Thank
Yay.
You.
Happy birthday. Yay.
All right. Thanks. Bye.
Going on and on the way we are for so something's wrong. As this way, say what you want to say, though I know your words will lay me out. So I can hear you think out loud. Going through your thoughts the way I have. It's clear to me the way say